Hey everybody, welcome to the Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor of pediatric surgery here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, home of the Badgers. This is a podcast about surgery and the people who are at the cutting edge of it. We're glad you're here.
Hello everyone again. I'm your guest host, Daniel Abbott, a surgical oncologist and health sciences researcher here at the University of Wisconsin. Our guest today is Dr. Joe Bieske, Associate Executive Director and Director of Evaluation at the American Board of Surgery. Dr. Bieske joined the ABS in 2008 after serving as Chief of Surgery and Director of Minimally Invasive Surgery at Penn Presbyterian Medical Center in Philadelphia. In addition, Dr. Bieske is also a recent past president of SAGES. Her clinical experience specializes in applications of minimally invasive surgery to all areas of general and gastrointestinal surgery. At the ABS, Dr. Bieske oversees the development and administration of all ABS examinations, ensuring that they are clinically relevant and adhere to best practices. So with that, we welcome Dr. Joe Bieske to the Surgery Set. I want to thank her very much for her time and energy in coming out to visit with us. Gave a wonderful Grand Rounds talk today that really hit on a lot of themes, and so I was hoping to ask a couple of more specific questions that relate to some of the themes you talked about. One of the big moves, it seems, in surgical education is a move towards competency-based assessment and progression. And I'm wondering about your thoughts about how that might specifically impact the low performers. I think that that is a wonderful advancement for maybe the high performers, but residents who might need remediation and who are benefited by simply a time-based advancement scheme. Do you have any concerns about the low performers and if remediation is going to be necessarily at an earlier stage or whatnot?
So I think it affects both the high and the low performers. We have this, you know, rigid combination of service and education. And if you took the service part out, then we could take as long as we wanted, just like you can take as long as you want for a PhD. But since we have the service component, we have a more highly structured forward pathway. So for high performers, we may find ourselves in the position of people who finish their training in 3.5 or 4 years or 4.5 years, but kind of can't be released because there's still a service requirement. That is actually what they found in the orthopedic surgery training program in Canada. And those people get the benefit of practicing in a mentored environment, essentially. You know, they can sort of hone their judgment like the old super chief year. The low performers, you know, I didn't talk about the board's 5 and 6 training pathway, which allows people to complete their training over a total of 6 years instead of over the previously mandated 5. And it's funny because most people who have to invoke that pathway don't want to. They don't want to spend an extra year of training. They don't want to be 34 when they're finished instead of 33 or 33 instead of 32. They want to move on and finish their training. But most people who actually ultimately do it are really pleased that they did. So I think we have to reframe that this is a thing for life. You know, life doesn't go on hold for your training. You know, you still, you know, have dinner and still work out and still live. And so it's not just a block of time to like get through. It's a part of the long process. So I think culturally we have to refocus on that. And practically, if someone needs to be remediated in a particular rotation, I think it's unlikely that we're going to be so fluid that we can kind of add 2 months here and 6 months there and 4 weeks here. I think it's going to be, my guess is it's going to be advancement by blocks, so that if you start to fall behind, you're not going to finish in 5, you'll be in the 6-year path, you know, or the 7-year path. And it falls back to the program directors to sort of accommodate the adjustments that have to be made. And then it would also require that the RC become more flexible in number of residents allowed on a given service or number of residents allowed at a different level. So there are a lot of pieces in play. I think it benefits low performers. Excuse me.
Do you fear at all that that allows for a 2-tier endpoint where you have the high performers who finish earlier on time, and some of these residents who might require 6 years are going to be viewed less favorably for a job, for a fellowship, and there's this stigma attached to those people going forward?
That's a good question. I would hope that we'll stop thinking of people as first-year residents, second-year residents, third-year residents who are repeating their third year and just be part of a sort of a more fluid continuum of surgery. So yes, if you say, you know, oh, weren't you a third year last year? Are you repeating third grade? You know, then I think there would be a cultural problem. You know, I see a lot of people take longer for their training. You know, people have always taken time off for research, but the 5 and 6 pathway, a significant number of people use that for either pursuing other interests, continuing their research, having a baby, taking care of a sick parent, you know, having their own illnesses. And I don't see that they've had any issue, any prejudice against them. So hopefully it'll all be part of the same thing. Surgery training requires that you pass all these various milestones. And I don't mean ACGME milestones. I mean, you know, conceptual milestones. And when you're done, as opposed to you should be done in 5. And if it takes you 6, that's weird. That culture has to sort of shift.
Mm-hmm. As a follow-up to that, what is the ABS view on resident autonomy? You know, I think if you compare resident autonomy now to 30 years ago, it's not even in the same ballpark. Do we feel that it's appropriate right now? It's inappropriate. And I think people who argue for more resident autonomy feel that it might take someone with the power of ABS or surgical leadership at a national level to make sure that residents have autonomy that they have lost.
So we recognize that as a huge problem in training and the sort of ludicrous nature of the idea that, you know, on June 30th, you can't do anything on yourself. And on July 1st, you can do everything by yourself. And, you know, that just doesn't pass any kind of practical sniff test. And, you know, the reasons for that kind of sneaked up on us while we weren't watching, you know, legislative requirements, pay requirements, malpractice. And so, you know, institutions themselves are very reluctant to give up the billing that goes along with not having a faculty member, you know, be the person who performs a procedure. Our hope, and this is quite aspirational, is that EPAs may be part of the answer to that. I'll take a step back and say we have the simpler hope that by continuing to increase the teaching assistant requirement for residents, that they'll get somewhat more of a chance to function independently, somewhat independently, because there still has to be a faculty member who ultimately is going to be responsible. And a lot of that depends on the nature of that faculty member, whether how much space they can allow the resident to actually take another resident through a case. So there's a limb of faculty training. And then there's the idea that, let's say you complete your right lower quadrant EPA. And I picked that one because an appendectomy was the first operation I did independently as a resident. As a second-year resident. So you complete your EPA, you're signed off by your, you know, peers and colleagues as independently able to assess someone and carry them through the surgery and postoperative management of someone with right lower quadrant pain, presumably appendicitis. Does that then open the door to say that you can bill for that operation? So in other countries, the answer to that is yes. So we do hope to push that forward. The board, interestingly, is not allowed to lobby. So this is essentially a Medicare issue, CMS issue, but the college can lobby. So that's one of the places that we work in concert with other organizations. So it's a lot of it is really about the hospital's resistance to not being able to bill for a given procedure. If a surgeon didn't do it, not only can the hospital not bill for the surgery, they can't bill for the anesthesiologist, you know, for anything else that went along with it. That's really the trigger. So it's quite a cascade. It'll be a while. But EPAs may be part of the answer.
Okay. Do you feel like the ABS has any role in advocacy for residents? And I ask that question in the context of clinicians are busier and busier. Oftentimes, the resident complement at a training center is the same, and so they are spread very, very thin. They are subjected to excellent educators, but also poor educators. And sometimes, I think one could argue that they should be selectively spending their time with good educators rather than poor educators. And so some institutions have dealt with that by putting PAs on services where maybe the faculty aren't great educators. Is that on the radar of the board?
Yes, and it probably needs to come into sharper focus. So, you know, part of the sea change in our involvement in surgical training has included the idea that we need better faculty training. I was on a panel, a multidisciplinary panel, about resident training, you know, in medicine and radiology and every other field. And at one point they turned to me and they said, what is the criteria in surgery to be teaching faculty? And I was like, an appointment on staff, you know, operating on any given day. And they didn't believe me. I had to actually repeat it about 3 times. And even then they kind of moved on, like, we'll have to get back to that because you can't possibly be right that every surgeon in the hospital is allowed to teach. So we're kind of outliers in the world of medicine on that. So, you know, written into our plan to implement EPAs is the inclusion of faculty training, and not everyone is going to be able to do them. And so I keep focusing on EPAs. Will they succeed? I don't know. But nevertheless, it's kind of opened the door to the idea that we need a much higher focus on faculty training. It all falls together. You know, if you have focused teachers, of course they're going to teach people faster. They're going to get to their goals better. If part of our goal is to make surgery training more efficient, not necessarily shorter, but more efficient, you need better teachers too. So yes, we do see that as part of our role. It's only now kind of coming into focus.
And my last question is, I think some people would say that changing adults is the hardest, if not most impossible, part of leading. And I think that's especially true in surgery, where there's some strong personalities and people trained in different eras. What do you think is the biggest culture shift that needs to change from the perspective of faculty and educators towards residents these days?
Oof. I mean, I was right with you for the first part about how hard it is to change surgeons. And what would be the biggest culture change? It's really accepting change at all. And, you know, change brings a lot of fear, a lot of anger. And at the bottom line, it's a lot of loss. So our peers, our elders, saw the world one way and they're losing that world or their role as they understood it in that world. So being sort of patient and respectful of that, but not letting that be the driver, I think is how we have to make change happen. I also think that recognizing that change makes people angry and not just collapsing when people are angry. You know, we started just as something simple, like we switched all of our item writing at the board to a computer program. Used to people could just write them down and send them in or send in Word files or send them by email or whatever. And for 3 years, it was like a meltdown. Everyone was angry, complaining, sending them in anyway by Word files. And now no one mentions it at all. So sometimes you just have to stand up and, you know, take the tumult. So I didn't really answer your question. I just think that there are ways of managing change. And one of them is to be empathetic to the people who are resistant. But nevertheless, you know, you really have to see your true north. Like, where are we trying to go? And is this path going to get us there? And the answer is the path we're on right now is not going to get us there. So we have to sort of be patient. I did want to say one more thing about resident advocacy, though, which is that our requirement for 250 cases in the first 2 years really was for the residents. It's like surgery is fun. Surgery is interesting. People like to be in the operating room. It's very easy to kind of delegate the least experienced people to do all the things that everybody can do. So we wanted to pull them back in the interest of having a better experience for them.
That's great. Well, thank you again for your time. We really appreciate your insights.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoy the Surgery Set or have suggestions on how we can make our program better, please provide us with your feedback. You can rate our podcast and leave your comments on iTunes, Podbean, or Stitcher, or you can send us an email at podcast@surgery.wisc.edu. Join me next time when I sit down with Dr. David Farley, an esteemed surgical educator visiting us from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Farley's innovative methods for surgical training offer a fresh take on resident education. He'll discuss how he uses competition to help bring out the best in his students, and will also explain why he's such a frequent shopper at Joann Fabrics. You won't want to miss it.
If you read something and just sort of assume you know it, it doesn't work very well. You can highlight it and read it again, but that doesn't mean you know it. You need to close the book and need to, all right, what did I just read? What are the questions? So therefore, assessment is really important. And I do a better job educating if I know where my learners lie.
The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Veronica Watson and myself. It was recorded by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to grand rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health video library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher, and of course you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page, and also find us on Twitter at @WiscSurgery or at @JEKohler, that's K-O-H-L-E-R. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and don't hesitate to let us know of any topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, we hope you check back soon.